You're listening to The Comedy Cellar, live from the table on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Comedy Cellar Show here on Sirius XM Channel 99. We're here the day after the midterms. Dan's very upset. Our guest, Chemda Khalili. Is that always been your last name?
Yeah.
Remember, you never went by it before?
Yeah, I usually leave it out because more people can't pronounce my first name, so we'll get through that first.
And Chemda was a singer in my band years ago. She's a singer and podcaster. She is the co-host of the long-running podcast, Keith and the Girl, which is one of the first podcasts to really...
exist?
No, well, to make a like a make an impact, a national impact. I mean, yes. You guys had one of the first people to have like a big viral following. And Sally, how do I pronounce it? Sattel. Sally Sattel is an American psychiatrist, lecturer at Yale School of Medicine, and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. She's the author of several books, including PCMD, How Political Correctness is Corrupting Medicine, and Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. Her writing often appears in such outlets as The Atlantic and The Wall Street Journal, where she penned the article, Does it take a shrink to evaluate Trump?
By the way, just before we get into that, Noam, I would like to issue a warning to you.
Yes, yes.
That she, I'm sure she's a very bright woman and probably has a lot of good things to say, but...
What a preface.
Don't be afraid to challenge her if you feel that something that she says is incorrect.
Wait.
Because you're getting permission.
Because
that's
sometimes
nice.
We have an expert, somebody that wrote a book, and you just assume that since they wrote a book, everything must be true. And I want you to go with your instincts because right. You have good instincts.
All right. So
I don't know that that's the case or not. I haven't read the book.
Now I read this column a long time ago, but I would say there's so many things to talk about with a real doctor. First of all, a psychiatrist is a medical doctor. It's not like a psychologist, right? Mm-hmm. So because I don't really believe in psychology at all.
I can write the scripts.
But psychiatrists, in my understanding of it, they actually view the brain as another physical part of the body. It's not like this mystical thing where you just talk to somebody and it just straightens everything out up there.
In the spirit of Descartes, yes,
do. Right. Talking to the microphone so I can...
I am, this is it.
There are psychiatrists that practice Freudian therapy as well that do believe in the talking cure, if you will.
Sure, but Freud was a neurologist, and actually he moved into psychoanalysis afterwards because he felt we'll never really capture the neuroscience of the mind.
Yeah.
And we're certainly learning things, but some people are very skeptical. And that's the ultimate question.
But I want to get to Trump right away. Did you see this movie, Three Identical Strangers?
Yes.
So I want to ask you about that later. Okay, so tell us about Trump. Is Trump a narcissist? First of all, is it okay for you to diagnose him without ever meeting him?
Frankly, not according to the American Psychiatric Association. But that's the whole point of what I wrote, is you don't have to be a psychiatrist. When you're talking about character pathology, personality disorders, which almost every one of my colleagues will endorse, say that he
has
such, and a certainly number of books have been written about it. You look at the behavior, and when you have months and now years of behavior and transcripts and TV doc. It's so well documented, his patterns of behavior and speech and attitudes and dispositions, that you have all the evidence is there for everyone to see.
That he's a narcissist.
Well, to be honest, the diagnosis almost doesn't matter. If you're talking about fitness for office, then you can observe the kinds of attitudes that he has. And it's no secret. It's not something that is privileged information. I mean, you can see the lack of curiosity. You can see the tendency towards the revenge and vendettas, and in his lack of knowledge about so much about the
world
and the political process.
But is it psychosis or carelessness?
Oh, he's certainly not. I don't believe he's lost touch with reality. Some might disagree, but I don't think we're talking about psychosis at all. It's a long-standing series of behavioral traits that served him quite well in one domain, don't translate very well arguably, so into the political realm.
Did you ever see that Did you ever see that Albert Brooks movie? Was it called Defending Your Life?
Yeah, that was great. Where,
and they, you know, and you get up there and they show like clips from their childhood that explains why. If you could see like clips from Trump's childhood, that in your mind would explain what we're seeing now as the adult. What kind of things do you think we see? Like that, that's
Oh my God, I so picture him being diaper changed at five. But you know, I'm not a psychiatrist.
Well, all right, you would if
a good question.
If you were dealing with a male narcissist, you'd probably hone in on, you know, wait for it, father son, you know, dynamics. And
what
I understand
would that...
they're quite complex. Well, they've really been. A lot of them have been exposed already in the press, but you would, I think, you'd look for patterns of whether the father, the kinds of expectations, whether the father showed much love, whether he...
you would think the father didn't show a lot of love?
I'm just throwing out the kinds of things you'd be interested in. Whether there was a sense that of unconditional love, that no matter what I did, I was loved and accepted. And you'd wonder if those kinds of...
No,
but those kinds of transgressions.
You're saying we don't need to wonder, and he's trying to ask
no,
you.
I'm saying that's what you'd look for.
Right, but I'm saying if you did get unconditional love as a child, that would make you less likely to be a narcissist?
Well, you know, these kinds of situations there's so many variables involved. But you know, formative years and relationships with parental figures usually figure pretty prominently in how your personality develops. There is a genetic dimension.
I was going to say, if you take identical twins separated at birth, yeah. I bet you they're both narcissists. That's my theory.
Well, temperament does have a significant heritable component. You know, whether you're a conscientious person, whether you can tolerate stress, whether you're open-minded. I mean, these things do have actually genetic components, and one would inherit that, you know, from a father and mother as well. So exactly as you mentioned, these sort of adopted away twin studies, that's why they're so prized in personality science and psychology, because at least you have one variable that's controlled for, which is a genetic composition.
Can I ask a question? If I had a kid, what behaviors would I be looking for, knowing that I'm creating a Trump?
Well, wouldn't it be based more on her behavior? If you had a kid, how you
What would that kid's response to my behavior or his atmosphere or whatever it is?
She wants to make sure she doesn't create a Trump.
Like, what are we looking for in our kid? We go, oh, we need to step back and talk about...
What are the danger signs of budding narcissism in our children?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Well, okay, one thing would be how he relates, or she relates to other, you know, his peers.
And how would they relate to others if they are a narcissist?
There's usually a deficit of empathy.
Okay.
And so that's very
important. How do kids display that?
Well, they feel... I mean, even, you know, Paul Bloom was a psychologist at Yale.
Because kids hate each other. I remember loving my brothers, and I broke their faces.
Well, that's different. You were like... there is a difference in siblings, the way siblings interact. But actually, babies, humans within the first year of life actually show a degree of empathy. And when they see another child being treated unfairly, in other words, every other child is given a piece of candy but that one, they might either give him that candy or somehow try to comfort them. I mean, this is, if something is expressed so early in life, it's clearly an inborn trait.
Well, I'll tell you this, of all the things you don't want your kid to be, narcissism is certainly not on the top of the list. You know, you've got borderline personality disorder,
depressed,
psychopathology, bipolar affective disorder,
pedophilia.
Schizophrenia. You know, all those things. So,
how many you've been diagnosed of on that list?
I'm trying to remember what I said.
I think
the
question with you, would you, if you're a parent, like Norm, you have kids.
Yeah.
So if you treated one of your kids better than the other one throughout.
The nicest one usually gets... Yeah, go ahead.
And always did that, I think he has a better shot at being narcissistic. Am I right?
Well, when it comes to how you form a personality, I think the important point is there are just so many variables. And you can see that with two kids raised in the same family, with the same parents, not separated by so many years that they've effectively grown up with other parents, which is the case if you're 10 when your sibling is born, let's say, and your father's already more wealthy or has lost a job or the dynamics in the family have changed. But even when kids are born closely together, raised together, gone to the same school together, largely share the same peer group, they can still be
Now, in terms of, we look at mental illness, one defines mental illness, or at least one definition, is that which impacts your life and makes it worse. Seems like Trump's having a great old time. Now, so to what extent, you know, is it really, at least for him, maybe other people are being adversely affected.
But don't narcissists hate themselves regardless of how we see it?
Well, that's why it's so hard, frankly, to get them into therapy, because they don't think that anything is wrong. And the typical scenario is the wife dragged them in saying, I'm going to leave you unless you get help. And he's sitting there with his arms folded. There's nothing wrong, honey. It's you. Or it's, you know, blaming, displacing responsibility on everyone else.
I have two questions about that. The first question, the first question is, I was reading about narcissism. And one of the classic traits of narcissism is a bad relationship with your children. And I just noticed that actually Trump doesn't seem to have that symptom. He seems to have a real bond with his kids, except for maybe Tiffany.
Most of the time the women raised most of the kids. He wasn't that involved.
No, but I don't know. I mean, they could be all an act, but it seems to me, like Reagan, for instance, Lee Famous had a bad relationship with his kids, and it was well known. I mean, it was just not a...
Yeah, but he wasn't as sexually attracted to his kids as Trump is.
But the other question, maybe the more important question is, if he has a personality disorder, does he warrant our hatred or our sympathy? Because I'm always confused sometimes. People say he's crazy. He's got cognitive decline. Whatever. So
I can answer that question.
Then why do they let the doctor say why do they hate him so much?
That's such a good question.
You wouldn't hate your grandmother if all of a sudden they started acting crazy,
right? But what I read about narcissism is that empathy feeds the narcissist, and so it scares me. So I love that you asked that.
Oh, well, doctor, go ahead.
I think, to tell you the truth, it depends on how close you are with them. I mean, if it is a relative, you can have both those sentiments, just like people have when they're, frankly, some family members have drug problems. Of course, they want the best for them. They wish they'd get help. But they also, you can't help but resent people who've made such a hash of the family sometimes. But
Can they get better?
It's hard. Personality disorders are hard to change. But one of the things you don't want to do is frankly, enable it. And unfortunately, when people are
letting him become president?
No. I mean, once...
Sorry.
But once you're in that position, and this is true of people in Hollywood, too, it's very hard to say no to powerful and wealthy people.
Oh, we know this. We know a lot of famous people, and... I haven't figured out the chicken and egg question yet, but there is an aspect to them that does seem to be different than you and me. The way they just basically dominate the conversation, will just change the subject as if no one else is talking, interrupt or whatever. I mean, Keith, you know what I'm referring to? Like,
yeah.
And
well, because they, when you, I think that the fact that when someone's made it, so-called made it or whatever, they feel like they have the answer to everything. When they get on top of the game, they're like the first one to talk. They know for sure what's going on.
And most of the time,
they're sure of themselves.
Right, even though it's just it just landed on you this time.
Well,
right.
I just wonder sometimes just after a certain amount of time of everybody just catering to you. Of course,
you're rewarded for it. I mean, it's simple.
You lose your way.
Well, it's also a lot of behaviorism. I mean... You do something, and there's no consequences, and there may even be a reward. So why not keep repeating it?
Well, I'd like to address briefly with Noam's question about whether we blame them or feel sorry for them.
Yeah.
Because I think that question has less to do with psychiatry and more to do with philosophy.
Okay.
And the answer is...
Oh.
I told you you'd get answers. Go ahead.
The answer to the question is no one is to blame, to quote the great Howard Jones. Remember that song?
Yeah.
Because free will does not exist.
Oh.
As the doctor may or may not agree.
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, you know, because I've made this point in the past.
No, we
can resent people because that's the natural human inclination. Mm-hmm. But to be perfectly rational, you wouldn't resent anybody. When I pass by a prison, I feel the same sadness as I do when I pass by a hospital. People that, through no fault of their own, wound up in prison or a hospital, to me, I see fundamentally no real difference.
Well, even if you are a hard determinist, and
that's right. A hard determinist is good to find.
Yes. even then,
that's officially your meme.
That's a good one, actually. But even then, which is to say, basically, you know, everything's caused, so you can't interrupt that causal chain. So. essentially everything that happens sort of destined to happen. It's not fatalism so much, but everything that came before leads up to what is present now. Well, even if you believe that, which I don't, I'm more of a compatibilist, you have to recognize that people respond to contingencies. They respond to carrots and sticks, incentives and
sanctions. Absolutely.
Hence the prison, which is
can we just agree?
I agree that we need to be prison.
That is a difference between hospitals and prison.
For deterrence as well.
Can we just get that out there? There's a definite difference between hospitals and prisons.
Okay.
Yeah, because he said
Dan's point is, I'm sorry.
What it really comes down to is whether a person has any control.
Yeah.
And people who are schizophrenic, who are hallucinating, who are psychotic, their control is significantly diminished.
But if we're going to let them slide, let the schizophrenic slide because he's ill, then we got to let the asshole slide.
That's what not guilty for reasons of insanity is. But I'm saying people who have personality disorders still can control it. You've seen him in various situations. That capacity still exists.
Right, but he thinks even the controlling it. So let me just to make clear what I think Dan is saying, is that everything is atoms, electrons, neutrons, all this, and if you knew every possible law of nature and of physics and how every atom will respond, you could from the beginning of time predict to the end of time, because everything happens as a response, as a predictable response of something else. And so what Dan is saying is that it's already in the cards, right? That's what you're saying?
Yeah, roughly, although...
And even in the hospital, even the medicine, even the doctor giving you the medicine, it's all one grand preordained thing.
Well, it may not be predictable, but it's also not...
Well, do you believe in randomness?
Well, I don't know. That's
that
getting
doesn't
into
get
quantum,
you any further. That's
quantum
scarier,
physics,
right?
But
if there is real randomness,
I'm just saying
then
this: if you were born in Braunau am Inn in 1886 to the Hitler family with Hitler's exact brain, you would be Hitler.
All right. So,
and that's it.
All right.
Does that mean we can't disrupt our own timeline?
That's what it means.
No, you can't. It's not fatalism. It's different.
Okay.
You can. You can.
Sorry, no.
You can deliberate. You can think about things. You can make different choices.
Well, but you're.
But you are. You are certainly biased towards making certain decisions based on your background.
Yes, but
There's
once
no
I'm aware of my bias, doesn't that change
it helps.
My time?
It can. That's the whole point of therapy.
Yeah, but you're a compatibilist, and I'm a hard...
Hard, emphasis
hard,
on the hard.
What's the word again?
Determinist.
And you're a
compatibilist. What happens to you when you change your mind? Does it blow your mind?
When I change my mind, it's because it was preordained that I would change my mind.
I see. So you would have come to that information that would have you change your mind. That's already predetermined?
Well, what I'm saying is that you are who you are. Without putting too fine a point on it. As I said, if you were born in Hitler's exact situation with Hitler's exact brain, you'd have been Hitler. That's my point.
I just want to say...
That but the doctor disagrees.
Getting back
he's a compartmentalist.
Compatibilist. Getting back to just the initial point is that it is not very evolved to think that somebody is suffering from a neurological decline and use that as a reason to hate them or to feel resentment towards him. They're sick.
Well,
and people can't seem to decide with Trump whether he's a healthy guy who is detestable or a sick person who obviously you're not supposed to detest a sick person. You can feel we need to protect ourselves from him, get him out of office, get him in a hospital, but you don't hate somebody for the manifestation of their sickness. That's why we don't put crazy people in jail when they commit crimes. Mm-hmm. So that's
well, we also don't put crazy people in jail because we feel that deterrence doesn't work with the crazy.
No, I mean, we do put crazy people in jail.
But we contain them for our safety, though, because...
But we don't punish
them.
Not,
that's right. We don't take a punitive approach.
Okay, so you also wrote, PCMD, How Political Correctness is Corrupting Medicine. I'm dying to hear about this because I believe it's true and I don't know anything about it. I guess how much I hate political correctness. Go ahead. Tell us how it's correct.
You're so delighted.
Because it has to be.
One of my favorites.
Because it has to be. I don't know anything about it, but it has to be.
Well, I wrote that 20 years ago.
Almost. Wow.
Yeah.
Snap.
And I could
you're so advanced.
Rewrite it, do an update. But in that book, one chapter is on something called, I think I called it Therapy for Victims, but it's about a kind of therapy called multicultural therapy, which actually still exists and is taught And in fact, at the University of San Francisco in their psychiatric unit, it was divided up, and I've understood from friends that it's this structure still exists. They actually have a ward for patients who are African-American, a ward for Asians. I don't think there's one for Caucasians. One for Hispanics. And
everything
so
else
words,
is for Caucasians.
Oh, that's how it is. But and the basic philosophy behind this is that the reason that you are having psychiatric problems, probably not outright psychosis, but depression, anxiety, difficulty coping, is because of the environment, because it is biased against you. It's just victimology on steroids. And it's such a dangerous way to do therapy, because the whole point of people who have problems in living, they have to know what part they can control, even if it's true that they may have been discriminated against. Even if all that is true, you have to think carefully about, you know, what are the things that can come under your control, how you can circumvent it. You want a whole kind of, you want to map out the landscape of factors that are impinging upon you. And some you frankly have no control over, and others that, you know, you do. So if you don't separate, put a lot of thought into trying to separate things out and say, well, I'm depressed because racism, that's not very therapeutic. You're not learning anything about yourself. You're not learning how to navigate the environment any better or your relationships, which is not to say that racism and, you know, malign forces in society don't exist. They do, but you can't.
And we're against them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can I say to your point of
we've been joined by Dave Juskow, by the way.
Hello, everybody. Don't mind him.
Go ahead.
The quote, I'm mad because racism, I think is just a starting point that I think people who are the victims of racism are saying because we haven't acknowledged that worldwide yet. So we're still yelling about that because we're still trying to acknowledge it, which is the first step. I know I'm not a psychiatrist, but it's the first step is admitting to blah, blah, blah. And I think that's part of the first step. And I think people are angry because everyone's responding from the place of, I don't agree about this first step. I don't agree that you're a victim of this. You could do this. You could do that. This is here for you. Blah, 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 is dismissing that first point and trying to rush through it to get to the rest of the therapy.
Right, but you know, I understand what you're saying. Okay. And I think there's certainly some truth to unacknowledged forms of oppression. But in a therapeutic setting, the job is to separate out what sort of was pre-existing and may have held you back and really may have been impinged upon you, and how you're reacting to it. There are more or less constructive ways to react to it.
But are people not looking for that? They're just, some people are stuck on that first step of racism.
They might be stuck on it, but the last thing you need is a therapist to come along and say, you're right to be stuck on it.
You're right to have felt this way. You're right that this did happen to you. You're right that these are the causes outside of you, but in your perspective.
Right.
Now we're going to go from there and go,
okay,
here's how you responded to that as a kid.
Exactly. It's just it doesn't go further.
But that's the therapist's problem, not the victim's problem,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But,
okay. Yeah.
But doctor, this is the thing. I see people reacting to things with tremendous emotion today that they didn't react to the same things when I was a kid in that way.
Yeah.
For instance, hearing a racist speaker. Like, I remember going to see, like, Mayor Kahana speak at Tufts, and you know, we handled it, you know.
But like you weren't the object of his ire.
Doesn't matter. Other people who were. There were Arabs there, too. And now people would be going into safe rooms and having, you know, trembling and crying. And I said, what's going on there? We're almost priming the pump. Let me give you another example. When Norm Macdonald got in trouble for defending Louis C.K. a little bit, and Jimmy Fallon had to disinvite him from The Tonight Show. And he said to Norm Macdonald, Jimmy said to him, Norm, people are crying. People on my staff are crying. Like, we can't put you on because of these words you said about Louis. And I thought to myself, well, like 15 years ago when Michael Richards used the N-word over and over and over again, like 2 days later he went on the Letterman show, and nobody told him how to go, and the staff didn't cry.
Yeah.
I'm like, why didn't they? Were they
holding
it?
There were no black people working on that show.
No. I'm being very serious. I feel like we're creating sensitivity here. And then humans, I mean, you could see, we see in different cultures, you can create a tremendous sensitivity to something and the response is real. But we're feeding into it rather than trying, like I said, a sensitivity training. We should be giving desensitivity training.
Well,
can I speak from...
Two things. The first is, and I know you've had him as a guest before, Jonathan Haidt's book, Coddling of the American Mind. That tells you a lot of how it goes into the elements of child rearing that may have contributed to this sensitivity. But I'll tell you, I think that my profession actually contributed to it in a way. And one of the things that captured me back after 9/11 was the obsession that psychiatry and psychology and the well-meaning helping professionals had about how traumatized the normal person would be after 9/11. Now, we're all traumatized with a sort of a small T, if you know what I mean, because it was...
traumatic.
It was horrific. Yeah. I mean, it was beyond imagining. But whether we needed professional help, if you didn't have that kind of outraged, horrified, I can't sleep, I'm numb, I can't even think, I can't concentrate. If you didn't have that kind of reaction, it would have been pathological. But the feds spent over $1 billion, and they just, I think, made one of their last installments last year for therapy. There was an... For New Yorkers. Now, clearly, if you were in the vicinity of the towers, had a relative who died, were involved, you know, yourself, and had a history of psychiatric difficulty, which can be exacerbated in the midst of a subsequent horrific event, then you probably were at greater risk for a significant depression or a significant or post-traumatic stress disorder. But the
would you say it would
person,
trigger you?
Yeah, yes. But the average person is quite resilient. People didn't need professional help. They needed each other. They needed information, which is what most people need in a disaster. They needed a community, which they had. And yet the expectation of fragility was so strong that people were basically urged, come into therapy. We can help you. You can't handle this yourself, which is an absolutely pernicious message to get out there.
Okay. I agree with you. I know you wanted to say something. So
I'm wondering if, from like a general perspective of just growing up, right? So there was a time where I was more emotional about just generally what happened to me, because all of a sudden I woke up from it, because I did get, sexually harassed and, all the stuff that comes from you grow up where we grow up and people are just empowered to kind of yell things at you and touch you inappropriately and whatever. And for a long time I dismissed it, and I wouldn't have called it any of these words that now we're putting on it, because it's just, that's how boys behaved. I expected it. I expected it. And when it happened, I understood that this is how sex was going to happen. They were going to try to convince me constantly until I gave in. When I woke up from that, like, oh, wait, I was taught wrong. They were taught wrong. They are actually continuing to do this. And all of a sudden, I'm upset. It seems a little out of nowhere, but I feel like in this waking up, when we wake up, even physically, we're groggy and we're a little emotional if somebody starts talking to us. I think that's what's happening as a society. And instead of yelling at each other awake, we might take into account that we're waking up at different times and that this is affecting us all of a sudden, quote unquote. And also on the second point is, I don't think that we're saying this all of a sudden. I think that a lot of people have been saying this for a very long time. And for the first time, it's coming into our Twitter feed or our personal lives, and we're finally admitting things to each other because we were empowered maybe by being anonymous on the internet or writing it down and sending it out instead of face to face, because we don't know how to deal with our emotions. And I think that's why maybe everybody went to therapy, because no matter what, you need therapy. No matter what, yes, you need the community, but we don't even know how to begin to talk to each other to create a community for ourselves. We've been shut down so much. Our generation, the next generation, then all of a sudden we're seeing these kids going, I know how I feel and I'm upset about it. That's only step one. I do think we need to take them to step two. Now we take accountability for everything that we can, and that's it. Does that make sense?
Well, but you're talking about, she's not denying the doctor, Dr.
Sattel.
Is not denying what you're saying. She's saying in certain instances, the psychiatric profession is encouraging therapy where perhaps none is needed in the situation of sexual harassment, and that the things that you were talking about, I don't know that you would have the same opinion.
I guess I'm talking about general trauma, so, you know, that's...
I just know that my father growing up would tell me stories like that basically, like, really rank, overt anti-Semitism was an everyday part of his life. And he was like, eh, you know, like, he didn't look
it
back at it.
It wasn't for you?
No, but it was...
For real. Like, it was for
no,
me.
No, not for me. No, no.
I went to a very anti-Semitic junior high.
Oh. Okay, so all right, hold that thought.
Yeah, which is
so,
more than I can say for the liver.
So my point being is that he just regarded it like that's the way it was, and he didn't feel particularly traumatized by it. And then today some kid would be in college and they see one, like, somebody draws a swastika in a bathroom somewhere, and they have a legitimate meltdown. And at some point I think there's something wrong going on, and they shouldn't be having that meltdown.
Well, part of it is because maybe in your father's generation this was expected. And when it's not expected, it's all that more dramatic.
I don't know.
So maybe it's also squished down. Like, our father, I don't know how your father is, but my father is not exactly...
Do you know...
Your father felt less threatened. I mean, when people feel threatened at baseline is when these kinds of insults mean so much.
He was alive during the Holocaust. This is what I'm saying.
But he was now in America.
So this was relatively benign.
But no, actually, the reason I became familiar with traumatology is actually the field. It was because I worked at a VA, and it was after the Vietnam War, but we still treated Vietnam era vets.
You look too young to have been
I love you.
In the profession at that time.
I was going to say the same thing.
My favorite hard determinist. again, in the name, I guess I should emphasize this more, that everyone's well-meaning. I don't doubt that for a moment. But in the name of trying to help these poor guys, some of whom were in combat, most of whom actually weren't. You know, only 15% of soldiers in the Vietnam War were actually exposed to combat. And then there was a penumbra there were others who were exposed to life-threatening situations, like truck drivers, this kind of thing. But most people did not have legitimate reason to fear for their life. They had other kinds of reasons to think about whether their sacrifice, no matter what form it was was something warranted. I mean, these are the kind of thoughts that soldiers have all the time, and they've witnessed horrible losses of their friends. But the point is, when they came into the VA, there was a rush to put them on, and I fear there still may be, a rush to put them on what's called service-connected disability. And these were people with rehabilitative potential. And unfortunately, they were in a fragile position. It was suggested to them, look, you've been traumatized by war. Effectively, you're not going to be a functional person. You get on that disability, and it becomes a cycle downward into invalidism, because then you don't work, and the less you work, the less you work. You know, your skills atrophy, any kind of confidence you have to return to the workforce erodes. And it's a very malignant cycle. And there are so many... men mostly, although now there are more women in the military, but who probably could have had much more productive and I'm going to say rewarding lives,
they
to the extent
back.
That reward has to do with how productive one is, not exclusively, but that's a big part of it. Yeah. And they were basically talked into the fact that they were trauma victims.
So can it all be true? Isn't it true that a lot of people suffered in silence in very many ways in our society for hundreds, thousands of years? Basically, since human beings began, and we are now waking up to some of those, like particularly like with transsexuals and sexual orientation, where people really had to live with this. But at the same time, it does feel great to be outraged, and when you encourage people to be outraged, they will, they will do it. And also, there is a sadistic element in human nature. And when you can twist somebody in the wind by making out that you're a victim of them,
it's a kind of power.
It's a power, and people will do it. We've all seen people do it. I mean, I don't know if this is quite related, but in this whole Louis C.K. thing we're going through.
I've heard.
You know, there's so many good arguments about me putting Louis on. But do you know how many people have written to me and referred to my race?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like it's like a tick now, and the patriarchy, and you're a white male, and you're putting Louis. I'm like, what does this have to do? Like, I could parade. Like, I tell you,
I think they're saying that you can't be a victim of this, so you have a different perspective.
I grew up at a time where you weren't supposed to talk about somebody's like, I can't talk about your sexual preference or your color or or my wife's when I'm making an argument about what she's doing that's right or wrong. That's a logical argument I'm making. But they, but now, except if you want to talk about white males, in which case some, and I'm like, and then if I try to defend myself, it becomes further evidence that, so it's like, I can tell that when I get these arguments, they love it. It's like they got me like defending myself. Like, it's like, I don't have to defend myself for being born white any more than a German has to be defend himself of being born German or somebody. I mean, it's madness. And of course the irony is that, like, you know, so many of the black comedians have no problem. There's nothing white about putting Louis C.K. on or not.
To me, that's symptomatic of the erosion of reason, frankly.
And yes.
But, you know, I feel, in some ways, I feel lucky.
But she's sympathetic to it. I can tell by her answer.
Well, no,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I can see it like, oh, yeah, it's okay to talk about white males. Okay, then let's talk about everybody's color.
No, I'm not saying that it's okay to just throw out because you're a white male.
Is it ever okay to bring up to somebody their color?
I think
when they're making a logical argument.
I understand what you're saying. It's like, it feels derailing. It feels like, what conversation are we having?
I was raised that was wrong.
Oh, we were raised as if we don't see color. But
no, not don't see color. That if somebody's making an argument about something, they make a point about principle, whatever it is.
I think we're learning about people's perspective based on...
I should be able to... If I want to make a point about something, I should be able to write it down on a page. And then I should give it to you to read it. And you shouldn't need to know, wait, what color was the person who wrote this? Then I'll tell you what I think of it.
What I think people are saying is that based on your response, we can see... your race and gender.
Oh,
does that make sense?
Well, yeah, that's not a nice... Maybe you think there's something white about putting... You think like a black club owner in my shoes wouldn't put him on?
If I were to bring up your white male cis whatever in the Louis C.K. situation, it is just specifically in that situation because you're not female. Just so you know, you have a different perspective. You don't have the perspective of ever being threatened by him in that way. Your perspective...
No.
You're shaking your head, but
I'm shaking my head because, yes, if you wanted to bring up the fact that I were male, I would understand that there is some connection. Like, maybe I can't identify with it because I'm a man, but not because I'm white.
I think you're a horrible person.
Now, having said that, I've gotten an amazing number of letters. I don't want to talk about Louis again, but just an amazing number of letters.
I love how many times you bring up Louis when you don't want to talk about him.
Because it's this whole PC thing. But I got an amazing number of letters from people who identified themselves as victims of sexual assault, who nevertheless felt that we were doing the right thing by putting Louis.
You're doing the right thing by
doing the right thing. I'm like 30, 40 letters like that. Meaning that there's no, you can't just predict somebody's opinion on something.
The thing that bothers me so much is that, you know, the tyranny of the group membership. You know, as a blank, I'm that. Well, you know, that's not necessarily true of everyone in that category. So that's important. But I think it is important, as I think you're implying, though, to consider, if you really want to have an in-depth discussion about someone's reaction to someone, is their past experience. But you do that on an individual level.
I get that. I feel like we're walking around telling people how many points they have over their head like we're video games. So you have the white point, the male point, the cis point, maybe because... but. To experience something that's different than other people makes you possibly have a response. So your name is Noam, right? Maybe you understand, like, where a name like mine, Chemda, everyone's going to mispronounce your name. That's what you're dealing with your whole life. So you add other things to it.
They used to call me Nutter Butterman, Nature Boy, Noodleman.
And that has affected personality.
I doubt it, but it could have.
But don't you understand it works both ways? And then now I can start saying to somebody, well, you're black, so that's the way you feel.
And how would you finish that sentence?
I would never say such a thing. I would only make the case of them where I thought they were right or wrong. Because I know, the same thing like the music string example, like the, if you want to argue about abortion with a woman. And let's say you're pro-life, and they'll say blah blah blah, and you say, well, you know what? I could get a woman here. It's not like the things I'm saying as a man that are pro-life. It's not like there's no women who are pro-life. So I got to drag a woman in here. So now you can't bring that up. So we can deal with the logic either way. To me, it's such a dodge. Like, just let's make logical arguments. Yes, of course. It is okay to point out to somebody, listen, you haven't had, we're talking about sexual harassment, and you haven't had that experience, so let me tell you what it's like. That's relevant.
Could you consider something like, you're asking them to skip over it, can you for now skip over it?
What do you mean?
Get to your
skip
point?
Skip over what?
Like, you're asking them not to bring that up. So when they bring that up, could you not respond to it?
I'm bothered by the fact that it's considered okay to bring that up. It bothers me a lot. I think it's society really moving in the wrong direction. It doesn't add anything to the discourse. As a matter of fact, I think you'll probably agree with me. During the time that they were, this is related in my mind somehow, during the time that they were protesting the Confederate statues, the Confederate flag, now I had known a lot of people from the South, including Jim Webb, the Democratic senator, who said, you know, yes, that was the Confederate flag, but when we were kids, we would see it everywhere. It was kind of our Southern thing.
That's my favorite. The Dukes of Hazzard was my favorite car, the
Dukes
General
of Hazzard,
Lee.
Whatever. And I said, how stupid to put these people in a position, rather than say to these people, listen, I understand that the Confederate flag means something not racist to you, but you have to understand how it makes me feel. It's a symbol of when we were slaves. And if you put yourself in my shoes, you would want to take it down. No, they don't do that, which I think would be very effective. That's kind of what Martin Luther King did. What they do is saying...
So they did do that already.
No, what they
do... You know what I mean?
What they do to them now is say, you're a racist. That's the only reason you'd have that flag is you're a racist.
And somebody, I have another reason why they would have that flag?
Hold on. And somebody says to themselves, well, I'm not a racist. And now you put me in a position where if I take the flag down, I have to admit to you I'm a racist. So go fuck yourself. And that's what you're seeing. It's like, just explain to them why it's wrong. Stop with the name calling. Stop with all of it. It doesn't help anything.
What is it representing to them that's different than the division of race? What does a Confederate flag represent? If you said, if I go, that's a racist flag, and you go, no, I have it flown for a different reason.
Right.
What is the reason?
Southern pride.
They would say, this was our, I mean, I'm not a Southerner. I just know what I've heard said, that this is something we always grew up with. It was the South.
And we're telling you that that represents racism. And right. So after we tell you that for a couple of decades, what happens?
Some people get upset and they start yelling at you. I'm making a practical argument here. I'm saying that it's not effective at all to call somebody a racist and put them in a position of, if they're going to do what you tell them, they have to admit to you that they're racist, especially if they don't feel that they're racist. And that's what's going on here. And I think that I think a lot of people were moved to take down these flags when they're explained how it feels to someone else. People have more empathy than people may realize.
So then you are saying that one side should have more empathy than the other side.
Every side should have empathy.
But do you know what I mean?
No.
It's like, you shouldn't tell me this. You should cater to me and speak to me a different way. You know,
if you want results, he's suggesting that the best way to get results is not to accuse somebody of racism straight away when they may not be racist. As recently as the 1970s, as Dave Juska was mentioning, nobody perceived the Confederate flag on the General Lee as racist.
It was the greatest car of all time.
You know, Bo and Luke were very sympathetic characters.
Do you think that everyone had that experience at the Dukes
of Hazzard? A lot of people did. So Noam's point is that people... What might have in those days worn a Confederate flag, Dukes of Hazzard shirt, and not had any racist notions.
Didn't think about it. Didn't even think about it for a second.
Yeah, actually, I'm living in Kentucky.
Racist.
And I've seen a lot of these flags.
That was a border state, I think.
You've seen the flags, and what do they mean?
I admit I never went up to anyone and questioned them, but I did ask others. I mean, not the people who had them on their cars, but I asked other people, you know, what does that mean to these folks? And they said, you know, it really isn't that much about racism, and they always say, I'm not saying that some people who have them aren't racist, but in general, it's, as you said, a pride. They call it a rebel flag, not so much the Confederate flag.
But the KKK calls themselves...
No, fair enough. Yeah. And that it also connotes a kind of... we're basically not the elite, we're not the establishment, we're not... This is our own... It's just wrapped up in identity, and almost a sense. One person said it was a kind of a middle finger to people who almost want us to take it down. But
that's my point. The middle finger to people, and that's a very natural reaction. I think.
States' rights.
A resistance. But
who are we blaming for that middle finger? Why don't we blame the person giving a middle finger as a response? Also,
That flag as a whole was kind of a middle finger to the North in general, right? Because it's like we won,
who gave the middle finger first?
Let the doctor finish.
Oh no. you don't need to be a psychiatrist to say what I'm about to say, and I think you agree with me on this, is that, and I often think, you know, I'm Jewish, so I immediately think,
what?
Hitler. What if there were monuments to Hitler? How would I feel? And I would maybe have to explain that to someone. I would hope not. But and then I think there's just a kind of human communal response, which is, well, frankly, if it's that upsetting, and I understand why it would be so upsetting, then we'll take it down.
They should take it down. Yeah. I've always been for them taking it down. Down. I was always going to sit in the state houses.
What he's against is accusing them of racism straight away.
What I'm against is what basically is the untruth. At root, it's an untruth of saying that everybody who has that flag is a racist. Because I know, we basically know that's not true. But we pretend that it is, and we tar them with it. And I think it's totally possible to believe that the flag should all come down, yet still...
Why do you think it should come down then?
Because it upsets some of our fellow citizens so much.
Why don't people who have those flags understand that?
Well, this, you know what?
I think some do.
You know what? Yeah, some do, but the thing is...
But they won't take it down.
No, but this,
but
is,
it's
but
not
this
racist.
Is the arrogance, forgive me if it's not word of your part, is that...
No, I'm really asking.
I'm going to answer you. You weren't born a young girl in the South growing up with it your whole life. You have no idea what that really means to them. And you think you know. And this is typical of people on all sides. We think we know. No. And in the same way you're questioning them, you don't stop and think, well, you know, let me think about it. Let me ask them. I don't know what it means to grow up in the South. I mean, I don't know much about all that history, but I do know that a defeated people, whatever that means, remains a defeated people, and they still consider themselves a people.
They
might cling to certain aspects, certain symbols of their people.
Yeah, and I'm saying stop it because I grew up a certain way also, and I went against the way that I grew up. So maybe I don't know what it's like to live in the South.
Okay, but at the point where you don't recognize that there's an awkward thing, like, well, okay, I think that what I'm saying is self-evidently true, that if you're calling people racist who are not racist, that's not a good thing. There's no plus to that. We should be accurate. And I think it's also true that the Confederate flag stands for the South, which had slavery, but does not mean support of slavery or lamenting the end of slavery to many people who have it on their cars or whatever it is, the Dukes of Hazzard, whatever it is. And so this is a difficult, nuanced situation. And I come down squarely on the side of taking down the flags. Yet some part of me, when I see the vitriol, says, you know, this doesn't seem to be quite the way I would handle this. You know, that's...
Wait, you
have to be all one or all the other, I guess.
This is just
right?
To be clear.
Yeah.
Do we... So are you saying, and I swear I'm really asking, are you saying don't yell racist at them?
I'm saying you shouldn't yell racist at somebody unless you're sure they're a racist.
Okay,
yeah.
But instead explain it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so...
That is how Martin Luther King made such progress in the Civil Rights Movement.
And then he got killed.
By allowing white people to wake up to what they were going through. He didn't succeed in getting the laws changed by calling everybody a racist, telling them what assholes they were. He succeeded by making people understand what they were going through. And that's how you get the Confederate flags to come down. By making people understand how it hurts them.
Yeah, so... It seems like you're saying we need to have more empathy than they need to have empathy.
Oh, no, you're putting words.
I'm not saying that at all.
I think you guys are just talking in circles.
Both of you have made your point, I think.
I'm not saying that at all.
I would like to make a book recommendation, which we don't usually do on this show.
Yes, yeah.
I read 12 Years a Slave, the book. I know you've all seen the movie, and books are always better than movies.
I didn't see that.
You didn't see the movie?
I couldn't watch it.
But if you really want to know what slavery was like, at least in Louisiana, where Solomon Northrup was a slave for 12 years, read this book. It will blow you away. And the movie, as is typically the case, is nothing by comparison. And also, the story of Solomon's rescue is far more interesting than what we saw in the movie, where they just kind of show up one day.
Yeah, they show up, yeah.
But it was far more intricate than that. So that's a Comedy Cellar book recommendation. Can we get to the midterms just briefly?
When were the midterms?
Hold on. I think it's backfiring is what I'm saying.
I understand that.
And I think there's a practical consideration that every movement needs to make about what is the best way to accomplish your goals.
That and Coleman? Coleman Hughes, everybody.
And I just think this is backfiring. I don't have...
We got Coleman's right over there.
All right, Dan. Go ahead.
Hey, Dan's excited. Hi,
I'm
Dan.
I'm excited to see Coleman.
Coleman! You want to join us for a second? Yeah. Come here 1 second, Coleman. No, so Coleman, so you're, we're in for a treat here because do you know who Coleman Hughes is?
Yeah.
Oh, she knows who you are.
Does he know who I am?
Be thrilled about it.
Coleman is a writer for Quillette.
What are we talking about?
So Coleman, how do you know who Coleman is?
We met at the Jonathan Haidt heterodox.
I remember your face.
Sally Sattel. Good. So, Sally. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too.
So Coleman, I didn't want to tell anybody. It doesn't matter what his race is. So we're talking about because I really don't think that should matter.
You're so late on that now.
We're talking about
now they're all wondering.
We're talking about the Confederate flag. Well, the name like Coleman. We're talking about the Confederate flag. And I was making the point that I thought that... given the fact that we know that not everybody who felt attachment to the Confederate flag...
What? You're leading the witness. I'd want to hear his thoughts without your...
What
do you think about the whole Confederate flag issue in the South and the way they handle it, getting people to take it down, all of that?
Well, I mean, I think on the one hand, it's clearly something that means different things to different people. For some people, it seems to have no association with slavery. It just has this kind of sort of Southern Pride Association. So I'm willing to extend those people good faith and say that they actually aren't associating it with slavery in their mind. But on the other hand, a mainstream reading of American history is that it is associated with slavery. It's hard to get around the fact that it's associated with the Civil War and the half of the country that wanted to defend that institution. So I also can't blame people who are saying, just take it down. I mean, for God's sakes.
And I agree with everything you said. And what do you think the best strategy is to accomplish getting the flags taken down and the monuments? You think the monuments should come down as well?
Monuments are so dumb.
Well, my position in these situations is I want to persuade people rather than force something down their throat, because that just seems like a recipe for resentment. And I think. I'm just one for conversation and persuasion over just forcing them.
So this is a beautiful example of what we were talking about.
But you
prior.
Know I am too, by the way.
No, I know. But I am.
I just can't blame the people who yell racist.
But listen to what a beautiful example we just had of something else I was talking about. He's black. I'm white. I made basically exactly the same argument as him. Yet, somebody would attack the argument because it came out of my white mouth. And my point is, with what I was saying before, it shouldn't matter that I'm white or black saying it. Because he could come, sit down, and say the very same thing, and now what you got?
I think it
now,
does.
Now you got to deal with the argument, right?
Well, I think it does matter a little bit more.
Really? So you're going to counter his argument with a different argument than you counter mine when we say the same thing?
No, but then I must have misunderstood what you said.
But my point, this is the world we live in where I will say what he just said, and instead of dealing with it, like with the Louis thing, they'll bring up the fact that I'm white. And I said to you before, I was like, okay, do I got to go find somebody black? Because I know there are black people who feel the same way.
No, I think we're misunderstanding. I was not arguing anything that he just said that came out of your mouth. What I was saying is, I can't blame someone for just associating the flag with racism for telling that person, hey, you have to be a racist if you're waving that flag.
I said that it didn't make sense that people bring up my color with regard to Louis.
Oh, well, we're going back to
stuff. No, but they're related. And, and he just proved exactly the point I was trying to make, is that deal with the words on the page, deal with the arguments, stop bringing up somebody's race or color or who they sleep with or what genitals they're attracted to.
Then you respond that way.
I always do.
That's it. But that's it. You know what I mean? That's all we have. Then if you're saying you don't want that response coming at you, then take what you like, leave the rest, and respond back. So they're calling you a white, male, cis person. You go, all right,
well,
and
never
you keep
cis.
Talking, and you keep
never,
talking. Whatever it
cis.
Is that they're labeling right. you that you actually are, keep speaking. You still are speaking from that perspective. Don't worry about it. If you're telling people to be kind and to understand and to empathize then, and you don't respond.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he does that. I don't think Noam stops talking, right?
No, I talk
when,
to anybody.
When someone
accuses him of being white.
The point is, it's asymmetric warfare, because when you label someone, you're a white person, so you don't get to talk about this. Don't you realize I'm black? My opinion matters more than you. My emotions are involved in this. That is such a powerful, at least it seems to be a powerful argument technique, that it's a bit of a conversation ender. You are taking up space as a white person. That's the argument. You're taking up space that doesn't belong to you.
Oh, he's taking up space, but it's not as a white person.
Right. I mean, well... Oh, okay. That was a joke about
his size. Yeah, it was a joke about just back. No, it was a joke that he's annoying. That's what
it is. Okay, okay. But you see the point I'm making, right? It's an asymmetric argument. It's not an argument between two equal human beings anymore. It's an argument that you fundamentally aren't as entitled as to an opinion as I am because of how I was born and how you were born.
Yes, I don't think we should take people's... But it's... Yes, I think people sometimes use it just to get back, just to shut down the conversation. But I think... Other people use it to say, hey, remember your perspective. You might be speaking from it without realizing and not being even. Not even, but you know what I mean?
You don't need to remind me of my perspective.
You might not be understanding what I'm saying because of that. Yeah. Sometimes it comes into play. That's all.
So sometimes.
And I'm not saying they should yell at you over everything and shut down the conversation. That's why I'm saying that it's up to us who understand that next level to then ignore that and keep going if we're going to have a conversation. We keep asking ourselves to be the better person. You know, you're saying, hey, why can't they be the better person? I'm saying we can't tell people to do that. We have to go, I'm going to be the better person from here.
It's much more than that. This is considered...
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. But this is considered...
Because we're all on the same side here is the most frustrating aspect of this.
This has seeped into, like, the highest realm of society that this is acceptable talk. You had senators referring to people's race during the Blasey Ford hearing. I mean, this is just we've lost all sense that this used to be something that we thought was anti-intellectual, and it's. I mean, if you're worried, we can talk about the midterms. If you're worried about Trump, this is fuel for his voters. I mean, there's only so many times the most liberal white guy is going to get shut down by somebody saying, you know, it's just because you're a white male. And he says, fuck that shit. I guess I am a white male. I guess I got to start voting my interest because these people actually, they seem to hate me and they discount anything I say by my skin color and my sex. So what? Let's end this charade. Let me vote with the people who don't think I'm an idiot. That's what they're doing. Anyway,
taking responsibility?
No, I think what they're doing, how are you going to get people to vote for you if your party, as it were, is ready to use what you were born as an epithet? White male has become an epithet. How can you get white males in the numbers that you want to vote for the people who view the way you were born?
You coddle them like we always did?
I'm talking practical results here. You're never going to get frustrated with you. I'm really just talking with you. I'm saying that it's wrong to use somebody's race as an epithet. It's wrong to use somebody's sex as an epithet. This ought to be basic civility 101, but it's not anymore. And it's going to have consequences. That's what I think it is having consequences, like these midterms. I don't know what I'm saying about the midterms.
That's a pretty good segue.
Yeah.
I called. I didn't until I texted Noam before the midterms, and I've never voted in midterms in my life because I just don't. But this year they seem so, everybody's talking about them. So I text Noam. Noam, I need guidance. I could just vote the Democratic ticket, which is I have done in the past. But I want to be more thoughtful than that. And I do have my issues with the Democrats on many levels. I said, Noam, give me some guidance. Help me out here. Who should I vote for? Noam wrote back, I have no idea.
I didn't vote. And actually, I read today that apparently true independents, a lot of them don't vote.
I didn't vote.
You don't vote. So, doctor, you traveled here. I want to make sure you speak as much as we possibly can. What do you want? You have anything to say about, you know, into politics so much, are you?
Almost by osmosis, since I'm at the American Enterprise Institute.
Oh, that's right.
Now the rural-urban split seems even more defined. And I stole this from the Daily, but it makes so much sense that now, as far as the Congress is concerned, basically now, this sounded right to me, that the House is going to turn into an investigative body and the Senate is going to turn into a judge-appointing body. And the tension and division is... probably going to even get worse.
I heard somebody on Facebook, wrote yesterday, they're complaining about the fact that the Senate is not a popular vote institution. And he says, we need to change we need to change the Senate. I don't want to be ruled by these rednecks. I said, well, maybe the ease with which you're calling them rednecks is part of the reason that it's good to have the Senate. You know, like, would you? Who wants to be ruled by people who dismiss them as rednecks? I mean, you know, and so
Well, was this a person whose opinion you normally value that wrote
this? Yeah,
this
is a smart person. I'm saying the hatred has gotten so visceral, but obviously, this having a non-popular vote body ought to then force everybody into the middle a little bit to try to something that everybody can agree on, which I used to think was a good thing for the country, but now apparently, if we can't have 100% the most left-wing.
Well, the founding fathers certainly thought it was a good thing as they put it into the
right. But I'm saying the left now feels if they have to make any accommodations, any slowdown, anything to these that this is an anti-democratic process, and they're really literally ready to burn down the house to get rid of the cockroaches. They're talking about ending 250 years of constitutional.
Coleman, you say what?
Well, I was just saying the counter argument, which has something to it, is that when that system was created, cities weren't nearly as big as they were. Now we have 8 million people in New York City, 20 million plus people in the state of New York. Each of them gets one Senate representative. And then you have, 1 million people in,
Montana or
Montana
something.
Or whatever. Yeah. So you get 500. So for something like the Kavanaugh hearing, in theory, you're talking about 500,000 people in Montana that have as much power as 10 million in New York State. And on its face, it seems that there's something a little upsetting about that in terms of if you're a New Yorker. I could see why someone might say, well, let's rethink this. Is this antiquated? Maybe it made more sense. Because it was part of the deal. I totally understand the historical rationale because it was part of the deal when states came together. They said, why the hell should we become a United States? I don't want to be subject to the whims of someone from some other state who has some different values. And this was part of the deal. And maybe it should continue to be part of the deal, but...
And certainly even back then, Maine must have had way fewer people than New York. I mean, way fewer.
So maybe the ratios actually haven't changed. I actually haven't looked at it, so I don't know. But would there be some ratio that's so egregious that it would be worth considering?
Right, if there were literally two people living in Montana, and then they had all this power, you might, at some point, you might reconsider it. For now, that's the system we have, and I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. Right.
I mean, if we were inventing it from now, I don't think we'd have the wisdom to have the system we'd have now, given the ratios and everything. But
that's true.
It's probably still, if we do want to have one nation, and we don't want it to feel like that one part of the country is so just running roughshod over the other part of the country, this is probably not such a bad system.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's perfect. I mean, if we were saying before, if we now only had, like when we were kids, three television networks, a half an hour evening newscast, and two or three local papers, and that was it, no computer, no internet, we would think this was the most awesome time in the history of the country. I mean, we have such a distorted view of how bad things are. Things are awesome.
And I think one of the reasons we have such a distorted view is because the folks who hold the distorted views and who are nurtured now in many college campuses, I think, to hold them, end up going into what I would call the amplifying institutions of the society. They end up being in journalism, they end up being in law, and they end up being in education.
Yeah.
So they're transmitting it. It's worrisome.
Yeah, it is. I know Coleman.
I think you're really right to point out how important it is that there only used to be three major networks because they had to appeal to a large amount of people. The more networks there are, the more they can hone in on a niche audience, and niche audiences have niche interests, niche political interests, and extreme political interests. So now Fox News can show some crazy person on the far left going off and calling white people this and that and import that to half the country and vice versa. And that just couldn't happen in the old days. So there are polls from the 1960s that ask people, how mad would you be mad if your kid married someone of the other party? And you get 4 or 5%. Virtually nobody cared. And now those polls are 30-40% people saying they don't want their kid marrying a Democrat or Republican.
That's sad. Okay, we're pretty much out of time. I love this group. I'd love to talk forever, but we're out of time. Anything you want to get off your chest?
I don't know. That was fun. I like talking.
Are you back to singing?
I'm starting to learn the guitar.
Ah. Okay.
I am terrible at it, but I'm practicing.
So when I used to be a musician, she was actually a fan. She used to come to watch the band all the time, and
at
then
Cafe Wah.
And then she sat in on singing sometime, and then we started like an Israeli band one time, and she was a singer, and then she became a podcast star, a national podcast star.
Coleman, by the way, plays a mean trombone. Oh, yeah, I heard him here a couple weeks ago on the Bone, and boy, can he blow.
Catch me on Monday nights at the Mingus Big Band.
Oh,
the
shit. Jazz Standard. I didn't know you had a regular gig.
A regular gig, Monday nights.
What? Can you imagine this guy? I mean, not only is he a well-known writer and intellectual, but he's an accomplished musician as well. And only 21 years old, I believe.
22.
And his most recent article was about Deepities. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a good article.
Oh, thank you.
In Quillette. I mean, I sent this to everybody I know. I don't know if I sent it to Dan. But I invite you to look up Coleman Hughes on Quillette. And he writes a lot about race. But this last article is not about race. And he's just as brilliant on non-racial issues as he is on...
By the way, Coleman,
such a good article.
You come in, every time you come in, the past few times, you've brought in a group of people with you. I haven't seen any repeats.
They
is it always a brand new group of people?
That's Nico Perino. You know,
that's Nico's group.
Oh, okay.
Nico brought me along tonight.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Because last time you were here with like three other people.
Uh-huh.
And I guess they were Columbia students.
Yep.
And then you were here with that dude whose grandfather was a big record guy.
Dan's way into you.
So one time Coleman told me...
I'm into Dan. I'm so glad I got to see you last time. You were hilarious.
Thank you, Coleman. So finally, good. I get the recognition I deserve. Yeah.
So did I say this to you? But you know, Coleman made his more than... not maybe twice made a comment about how much older I am than he is. And
good job, Coleman.
And I said, you know, I might as well
tell him he's white too. He knows.
And actually, Harry Anthony told me like called me like a father figure. I'm like, it's so weird for me because I don't feel any different than I did when I hang out with Coleman.
I agree. So I feel the same.
So with this Deepity, he says, well, age is just a number.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a classic example. That's a classic example.
Just
a
number. But I guess it's not because Coleman sees me as an old man. Anyway.
No, part of the reason I point that out is because it doesn't feel like I'm hanging out with an old person.
Oh, it doesn't.
Either. Like I don't have that many like 50 plus year old like friends. You know?
I'm not really 50 plus. I am 56.
Oh my gosh, you're 56? Holy moly.
56 years old.
Wow, that's I'm 49, but I'm already like, and I just turned 49, but I'm already like, I basically call myself 50 because I know it's going to be traumatic, so I might as well get it over with and just say I'm 50 now.
Yeah, people my own age I can barely tolerate them. Mm. They're so set in their ways. They're not curious about anything. I mean, they're anyway. Anyway, you agree with that, Doc? She's nodding her head.
I agree with everything. Yeah.
Well, you're only in your 30s.
Oh,
so.
I am.
So, Doc, did you have a good time coming here?
Oh, I had a great time, and actually, I realize how. If you take the sort of the therapeutic mindset, it is really one of the most constructive, I think, lenses to use because it really dovetails with the conversation you were having about race and groups. Just forget the group. You have to focus on the individual. That's what you would do in any kind of therapeutic, you know, exchange and setting. It's what's meaningful to you. What can you control? How can you make better choices for yourself? But it doesn't matter. The word groups and labels don't even come up.
True or false? Black men don't go into therapy because it's not masculine.
Don't group.
That's cool.
I mean, just, well, are we grouping or not grouping?
Well, neither do, you know, rural white, poor white men either. So, well, I mean,
or any real man.
I would definitely guess yes on that. That there's a disproportionate masculine thing against therapy in the black community, for sure, among men. I would guess that.
It might
open
be,
to being
that's
wrong,
an empirical
though.
Question.
Yeah, it's an empirical question.
And
question.
We'll have the answer to that question in our next episode.
Well, look, the irony is that to say what you're saying or what I'm saying, to focus on the individual now makes you sort of a conservative when the doctor and I are old enough to remember that it used to be exactly the opposite. That was what a liberal was. And after like 50, 60 years of the civil rights movement, who knew that the ultimate... nirvana, the ultimate conclusion of wisdom would be that, yes, it's okay to generalize based on race. We were just talking about the wrong race. we got to the end, and actually the only mistake we were making is that it's okay to talk about white people, but all the other races are still, and that's kind of absurd, right? All right. Thank you very much. Dan's leaving. Please email us podcast@comedyseller.com, podcast@comedyseller.com. Dan, we've been extended for another year on Sirius Radio.
Oh, well, all right.
Congrats.
I guess, you
6 years.
Are we going to be extended on Comedy Central is the bigger question.
I don't know.
And I did want to get into that, but we didn't have time.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Blah, 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 blah.